What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. Coming up on this week's program, you may remember there were a couple of American military personnel that were on video recording unidentified flying objects. They couldn't understand how these objects on their screens were moving, and these were then validated by the US military as being genuine articles. Well, the US government recently filed a very flimsy report. We're going to be talking about what the state of play is and why we need to, I suppose, talk about UFOs and alien life in a more serious way with astronomer Chris Impey. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining me via Skype is Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Susan Kelleher from DCU. You're both very welcome. Our first story has been covered a bit, I suppose, in the papers, because it's quite a remarkable one, Shane. It is that Ireland is predicted to be one of the best places to seek refuge from essentially the end of society.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the five best places to survive global societal collapse. Now, the important words to emphasize there are global societal collapse. So it isn't going to be good anywhere, but we're listed as one of the five places that might do, you know, relatively well. And this is a study from Cambridge in the journal Sustainability. So Ireland is listed alongside New Zealand, Iceland, Tasmania, and the UK. So what have they all got in common? They're all islands, and
I know.
They're all in the temperate zone of the world. And so this has got an awful lot to do with why we're special, so-called. And they've run some scenarios and said, you know, if there were to be a confluence of various disasters, so if climate change were to, you know, to go the way it's predicted, if the destruction of biodiversity were to go as predicted, and we were to have something like another pandemic or a severe financial shock on top of it, they're saying, well, what would happen if societies were to start to break down? So they assessed the resilience of countries to such shocks. And they looked at things like our capacity to grow enough food to feed the people that live here, our capacity to protect borders. And you can imagine why that's an issue. It's to prevent influx from refugees, which is an awful thing, the way they assess this in the paper. But this is what they did. They also look at the capacity of the country to maintain some element of electricity and for the country to have a basic manufacturing capacity. So to make things to keep society going. Uh-oh. And yeah, so we come out relatively well on that. Perhaps unsurprisingly, New Zealand comes out top because they have geothermal energy. They also have very low population density. And as we know from their success with zero COVID, they are miles and miles away from anything else. Yeah. So
how did you get
imagine
there
Hawaii. Hawaii would be quite good. You would have imagined, but I guess they're in the tropics, right? They experience severe weather, and New Zealand certainly is very sparsely populated. I suppose the idea of the refugees is, if the whole world is uninhabitable, the idea is that you put up the gates on the island, and you say you can't come into our perfect island. Like this scenario is terrifying.
Well, it's happening already. Like, so the leader of the Defence Forces said that the greatest threat to Ireland at the moment is climate change. And he referenced conflicts that are happening in sub-Saharan Africa due to desertification, which is a result of climate change, and the significant migration of refugees as a result, because people can no longer live where they once lived. So this is not a sort of 50 years from now scenario. Like, I don't wish to sound, like, you know, terrifying here, but climate change
is happening
now. Why not?
It's a bank holiday.
Exactly. So, this is written in a journal called Sustainability, right? That's important to emphasize. So they've done this exercise because they say, like, we have the capacity to think about these things and to build in better resilience into the way we live. And they say the globalized society that is predominantly focused on short-term economic gain does not build in the resilience that the world needs in order for it to take these shocks and to survive them. Mm. And they point to the significant successes of how the global order has reacted positively to COVID-19 and suggest that, you know, we can do similar when it comes to issues like biodiversity and climate. So when we want to, and when our backs are against the wall, we can show what we're made of.
But that's the problem. When our backs are against the wall, COVID was a live or die situation. The slow death of species across the world is not really as pressing, unfortunately, just now, but of course it may be in time to come. Anyway, let's move on to something a little less cheery. Our second story, Susan, has to do with eye movement, and essentially it's changed a little bit about how we understand how the eye works.
Yeah, and what we know about how our eyes work, exactly. So wherever anyone's listening to this, I want you to do something. I want you to look at something to your right and then move your eyes to look at something to your left. So changing your focus from your right to your left, and think about what's happening when your eye is moving. So in the in-between time when your eye is moving, we don't really see anything at all. And it was believed that essentially you're sort of blind in that moment, unless you're looking at two things and comparing them, we're not really seeing anything in our surroundings. At least that was understood until now. So researchers in the Humboldt University in Berlin have discovered that our eyes do in fact pick up things as they're focusing when they're moving from two points. So they're picking up things during these what are called rapid eye movements, when your eye is actually moving from one point from A to B. And these points are, these eye movements are called saccades. And what they did was they essentially got volunteers to sit down and look at a computer screen, and they had images pop up, and they think of it like a whack-a-mole. So the mole is popping up and you're focusing on, the image is focusing on it, you're focusing on that image. And then what's happening is when the second mole pops up, your eye then moves to that. But what actually happens in these saccades when your eye is moving is that you're able to see a sort of a bit like a ghost of the first mole. So I would liken it to Roadrunner when he darts away and he leaves a shadow of himself behind in dust. So it's essentially like that. So we always thought we just saw the image A and image B, when actually we're starting to understand that when your eye moves in these saccade moments, that you're actually able to pick up small memory, or kind of like a memory or a shadow of the different images as you move from one to the other, which is really interesting, I suppose, from the point of view that you think we'd know an awful lot about our eyes by now, but this is something that is, you know, was very unknown, in fact believed to be not possible and wasn't expected at all to be the case, and they've just discovered this by using this kind of rapid eye movement study with the computer screen, that they do in fact pick up more information than we think.
Yeah, there is a test that some people do when they're talking about vision, and they say, you know, put your finger on your eyeball and keep it still and you'll go blind. And this is something that I've tried, and I mean, unless I press really hard, I didn't actually go blind. But the idea is that if your eyeball is not moving, you don't have sight. And sight is generated in the brain by comparing tiny differences of point A to point B. And that's what these saccades were thought of, that you basically flick from A to B, A to B, A to B, completely subconsciously. And that creates a sort of a moving picture of the 3D world around you, almost like the flickering image of a film stock as it goes through a projector. But actually, this would sort of refute that. If you can see in between each of the two pictures on that reel, then it makes us think that perhaps vision is constant, which is a totally new thing. Shane, our third story has to do with black holes and being able to see around the back of them, which is quite an achievement.
Yeah, and you would think impossible, given they are black and that light shouldn't be anywhere near them. And this is a recent piece of work from astrophysicists in Stanford in the United States. And they are interested in looking at supermassive black holes. That's the big ones. They were looking at a particular one that's 800 million light years away from us. And they were interested in it because of flares that are associated with it. Now, listeners might think, black hole, how could there be flares? Where's the light coming from? So what's happening here is the black hole is pulling in gas. And as it does so, that gas goes into a vortex. It starts to spin. And you get this very, very energetically complex area of space where you can the friction, as it were, of that sucking in creates flares, incredibly energetic forms of light called X-rays, and they're emitted. And that's what the astrophysicist was looking at. However, when the astrophysicists were looking at this area, they noticed that there were also echoes. So they went looking for a particular thing, they saw it, and then they saw something extra that was very faint, these little echoes, these small flares. And when they went away and looked at the associated physical theory, they reckoned that the best possible excuse for these was that this was light coming from the other side of the black hole. Which is absolutely incredible. The first time that that has ever been observed. And it also is yet another piece of evidence to support the famous Einsteinian general theory of relativity. Now, Einstein, as listeners will know, is famous for the equation E equals mc squared. But perhaps one of the most fundamental pieces of work he did was to be able to relate space, time, and gravity, these big three things, where space-time is like the fabric of the universe and it is deformed by areas of high gravity. And of course, a black hole has extreme gravity. It's a singularity in space-time. And so what's happening here is the light is literally being bent as it goes around the black hole. And that's where we're getting these faint echoes from. This is just the very beginning of astrophysics in this area. The European Space Agency is about to put up the Athena telescope, and it has a bigger mirror, and as we all know, astrophysicists love things getting bigger, so they'll be able to see with greater precision these echoes around supermassive black holes, and perhaps to be able to tell a little bit more about what makes up these incredible structures.
Whether it's behind or the flares from the vortex, how do they escape the pull of the black hole? Though I thought that was the whole point, that the black hole sucks in all light.
It does. It does. It sucks in all light beyond a point called the event horizon. So after that point, it's entirely black. Of course, there is gravitational effect beyond the event horizon. And so you could imagine it's light.
If it's right on the edge of it. Yeah. It some of it may, as it goes in all directions, the bit that's traveling fast enough and far enough away from the black hole might escape.
Do you know what's a really good analogy, actually? Do you know those pinball machines like when you go to the amusements and you have those dips in them and you shoot your little stainless steel ball and it zips along. It might go down into a dip, but it has enough momentum to come up out of it.
Yeah.
But its path will be deflected having gone through that dip. That's effectively what's happening with rays of light as they go through these gravitational wells caused by black holes.
Susan, our final story has to do with bees who are buzzed up.
Yeah, it turns out we're not the only animals to get a boost from caffeine. This is about feeding bees caffeine and the effect that it has on them. The work was published in the journal Current Biology, and it shows that bumblebees that get a caffeine hit are better able to remember the odors of specific flowers, and therefore might help them to find those flowers in the future if they're important for their health. So it was previously reported, this is really interesting, that bees prefer flowers with naturally caffeinated nectar. So the flowers of, the coffee plants, you know, that would obviously have caffeine in it. But they didn't really know why. Researchers had no idea why this was the case. So this work shows that the caffeine actually enhances the bees' learning and memory skills. And it was performed using, and I didn't get to see the image of it, but my imagination took me there, robot flowers. So which was really quite cool. So they fed bees strawberry scented nectar in their nests. Half of the nests had strawberry scented nectar with a drop of caffeine and half didn't. Okay, so they're both drinking the same strawberry flavored thing and half of them have a drop of caffeine in them. Then they let the bees into a room full of robot flowers, so sort of a robot flower meadow, where half the robots smelled like the strawberries and half of them didn't. And the bees that had, both sets of bees like the strawberry scent. This is the thing that they want to go towards. And the bees that had the caffeine went to more of the strawberry scented flowers than the ones that didn't. So they were, basically the researchers think that they remembered from when they were in their nest that strawberry scented gives, you know, flowers give really nice nectar, and that's going to be a good thing. So the ones
that
have
a bit of a stretch though
it.
to imply yeah. that link, doesn't it?
Like
it,
they did a lot of controls, you know, they did a lot of controls in like bees that only had sugar and bees that had no caffeine right. and bees, you know, so they did a lot of controls. And it is like, it's just like, rather than a 50-50 chance of the two types of flowers, the ones that smelled like strawberries and the ones that didn't, you know, the other bees went just randomly to them. I mean, they were able to dictate or able to figure out which robot flower they landed on. They took nectar from it, and then the robot flower filled back up again, and they proceeded throughout, and they were able to track them. And then the ones that had the caffeine were able to, they went to about 70% of the ones that were smelled like strawberries. So they had a really, like a much stronger preference for the ones that smelled like strawberries, which they believe is because that's what they learned in the nest.
But did they bring back the same amount of nectar is the question?
They because, didn't study that actually. It was yeah, just the
because I mean one of the ideas could be that the caffeine somehow impeded their ability to measure how much nectar they needed or were carrying, and that's why they had to go to more flowers where the other ones more. Were happy enough and they were sated. I mean, I don't know, but I was just wondering if they hadn't
quite looked at that, but yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just an interesting study. One thing that they say this could be used for is that if you have a field full of crops and you want certain crops pollinated and there's weeds and wildflowers around as well, if you can train them with sort of enhance or enticing them early in their life to like the smell of the crops and then enhance that with this caffeine, that perhaps you'll get just a little bit more pollination of the crops rather than just randomly any flowers in the field.
All right. Well, Dr. Susan Keller from DCU and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks very much. Now, if you were watching the news, you might have been quite bemused to learn that in the United States in June, a 9-page report on 144 sightings by military personnel of unidentified flying objects landed on the desks of Congress members. It was a very scant report on what seemed to be very credible sources for unexplained phenomenon. It made for very brief but very interesting reading. Here to talk to us about it is astronomer in the United States. His name is Chris Impey. Chris, welcome to the program. Would you mind maybe perhaps giving us, before we talk about the report, an explanation of why you're interested in this subject and what your background is?
Sure. I'm a professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona. So astronomers are in a very interesting position regarding UFOs. Most of us don't think the evidence that aliens have visited the Earth is credible at all. And most people just think, scientists for the large part, don't think it's happened. However, astronomy has now gone a long way down the road of finding planets around other stars. And we can project tens of billions of habitable planets, Earth-like planets in the galaxy, just our galaxy. And there's tons of time for them to have evolved life and maybe intelligent life and technology. So it's not, you know, ridiculous to hypothesize that there are intelligent aliens out there. It's just that astronomers don't think they visited us.
Let's talk about the report and then we'll talk about how it's been received and whether or not there were things missing from it. What was in this 9-page report?
Not much. And if I were a taxpayer, which I am, the price tag of $22 million would make me a little mad, because for 9 pages of a nothing burger, if you like, they would not make, could not make definitive interpretations or conclusions regarding almost all of 144 sightings. And they ended it with saying, well, we'll come back in 3 months and tell you about how we're going to collect better data and do better. And, you know, so just hang on and we'll give you another update. So there wasn't much in it. There was no data in it, of course. There were no, the word UFO doesn't appear because the military has rebranded this phenomenon because of the stigma attached to all the conspiracy theories and so on as UAP, unidentified aerial phenomena. The word alien doesn't appear in the report, the word extraterrestrial. So they just don't go there.
I kind of get that, to be honest. So the reason why this is interesting is because there were some leaked videos, and you can see them on our Twitter page, twitter.com/newstalkscience, taken from what appeared to be the in-cockpit cameras of military aircraft, in which things moved around in a way that, I don't know, just even the way I'm saying it, I'm starting to sound like a crazy person, but moved in a way that didn't seem to fit with our current technology. Can you explain why this was of such interest to people like Marco Rubio and the American public because of these videos?
Right. Well, to unpack it a little bit, a little context of history is useful. The military has been studying UFOs or documenting the phenomena since the 1940s, pretty much since Roswell, 1947. And for most of that time, it's been secret. And so the public has not learned about it. These videos were actually first leaked in 2017, the ones you're talking about. And then only last year did the military come out and say, yes, they're ours and they're legitimate, they're genuine.
But that was a really big deal, right? The military to say, yes, these are, because there's so much stuff put up there by, you know, paranoid activists and fakers, that for the American military, a very credible source to say, yes, this is real, and no, we can't explain it. That's a big deal.
Right. It's a big deal. And it's also a big deal that they were being public about it. Mm. As you can imagine, the fact that they have had secret UFO studies over the decades has always fueled the conspiracy theories that, oh yeah, the aliens are there deep frozen in Area 51 and the government's just not telling us about it. As you know, America is prone to conspiracy theories, and they just fed into it. So it was good that they did a report, and then Congress essentially told them to do it. It's also relevant that it came from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, because for the military and for Congress, the big concern is not the aliens, little green men are visiting, but the fact that there's a national security issue. There's the report did not close the door on the fact that some of these sightings could be technologies of American adversaries, you know, hypersonic drones or whatever, you know, just advanced technologies the Chinese and the Russians might have. Mm. And then just the fact that there are all these things, you know, appearing near Navy pilots while they're doing their work is a national security concern. So that's why it came from the Office of the DNI. As for the three videos themselves, which were again leaked 4 years ago, a guy called Mike West, who does a good job on debunking various pseudoscience things, he's already pretty much explained all three in terms of optical artifacts. So sometimes what you see is not what you get. It's not obviously against physics or obviously alien technology. You can be fooled, and Navy pilots are, of course, expert people in their field, but when they see something unfamiliar, they don't know what they're seeing either. You can be an expert and highly trained and still not be able to interpret or understand phenomena you see. Hmm.
And so those three sightings have been roundly debunked. What were they?
Well, they've not been completely debunked. That would probably not be fair to say, because the person, Mick West, I'm talking to, who's got YouTube videos purportedly explaining them quite simple, mundane ways. They're optical artifacts due to the...
like dirt on the lens or noise on the screen, essentially?
Reflections inside the cameras, or there are sometimes iris effects on how they stop down the aperture. There's a set of different phenomena going on. Now, he's tried to replicate it without using the military's hardware, so I shouldn't be too definitive in saying he's debunked them. But the simple fact is, of course, that these videos don't have critical information in them. When you see a video or an image or even radar, it doesn't tell you how big the thing is, and it doesn't always tell you how far away or how fast it's moving, especially when it's just video. So you're missing crucial information that you would absolutely need to interpret what you're seeing. And so only a small fraction of the sightings, the 144 in the report, had multiple sensors, as they talk about it, to give you a little extra handle on what's going on. So the fact is you're not dealing with a lot of information for some of them, and that's why they couldn't interpret almost all of them.
I mean, the director of National Intelligence dropping a report that really has hardly any information in it, is that not a red flag? I mean, I'm using talking about red flags now, I'm really going down the conspiracy route, but wouldn't that be even more fueling the conspiracy theorists even more, that they basically said, yeah, there's nothing here. Like, there's a lot of America that does believe that there are aliens, or that there is some sort of sighting, right? The numbers are quite high in the States.
It's about half of the American public think either that they are visiting now or have in the past. Yeah, that's the fraction.
Is that credible as a statistic?
that's like from Pew surveys or Gallup polls. I mean, that's pretty sturdy, that number. So it is pretty much half the American. Now, how hard, how strong a belief it is. Yeah. People have kind of weak beliefs. Some people believe in astrology, but they don't run their lives by it. So, you know, it's a question of how sincere and deeply held the belief is. I suppose if you think you've been abducted by aliens, that's a pretty deeply held belief. For most people, it's not quite that deep. So the DNI is, of course, interested because of the potential national security threat of these things, whatever they might be, unless they're all artifacts. I don't think they're all artifacts, but as you say, very little information in the report, bit of a damn squib, really. And so they're supposed to come back to Congress in a couple of months and not actually present data, but just say how they're going to get better data and also overcome the stigma that their pilots feel about reporting it. So they realize the phenomenon's underreported because many pilots aren't too embarrassed to say they saw something that they might think was an alien or a UFO or they couldn't explain.
And why not put scientists, visual artifact scientists, optical scientists to work looking at recreating these sort of things to sort of put the public's mind at ease and sort of dampen down this hysteria that appears in some dark corners of the internet, let's be clear. Right. That there are aliens visiting us. Why not have this information out in the open and allow public and members of the scientific community to say, look, this is why and how this is happening?
Absolutely, I agree. And that to me was a missed opportunity of even this small report. They could have opened the door and said, we're going to convene a panel of scientific experts of the appropriate backgrounds to work with us on the data. Some of them might have to have security clearances. That's fine. Many of them could get that. And they did do that, or they haven't done it yet. Maybe they will, but that was a missed opportunity. And as you know, I mean, scientists, because of the conspiracy theories, because of the whole, you know, cloak and dagger aspect of UFOs, just don't want to get involved. But under the cover of the military, your national security director saying, please help us understand this, they would participate. In fact, a recent example of this is the U.S. military has convened scientific experts to try and understand the Havana syndrome, where over 100 American diplomats have been afflicted by possibly microwave radiation at embassies around the world. And that's a mystery too. And they want to get to the bottom of it. And they've convened two panels of scientific experts. Right. So they have a model of how to do this if they want it.
Why are you so interested in this, though, Chris? Because you're commenting on it publicly, and as an astronomer, it's probably one step away from your day-to-day, right? So why is discussing these unknown sightings, UAP, so to speak, unidentified aerial phenomenon, why is that of interest to you?
Well, I mean, it comes down to the core and essence of being a scientist. If you're a scientist, you're curious. And if you're a scientist, you like to solve a puzzle and a mystery and, you know, about the universe, maybe a black hole or a galaxy or something like that. So for me, just throwing the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, of the fact that there's some maybe core of sightings that are genuinely needing explanation. They're not people who were misled or mistaken. They're not artifacts. They're not astronomical objects that people didn't recognize. But that's a mystery that deserves some attention. So I think my colleagues generally, I understand why completely, but I think they've been a little, you know, blanketly dismissive if of the whole subject,
yeah,
when there might be a core of a phenomena that worth studying. If you had data, you know, yeah, most astronomers and scientists would say, okay, you know, forget the videos, forget the images, forget the eyewitness accounts. What about some physical evidence? You know, give us some physical object. If tens of thousands of aliens are visiting, you know, a year or over the decades, why don't we have a single physical object we can study in the lab and other scientists can look at? That's part of why scientists are so skeptical.
Yeah. And at the same time, you know, we've seemed to sort of culturally put believing in ghosts and believing in aliens in the same category. And it's like they occupy the same part of my brain. And yet I know statistically the chances of there being life outside of Earth, whatever that might be, is pretty high. And the chances of there being ghosts is reasonably low. But it's funny. I'm sure even talking about this as a scientist has gotten you, you know, probably... I mean, I won't put words in your mouth. How has it affected you speaking about this sort of thing as a scientist in America?
It's, you know, I talk to my colleagues. We're still under COVID, so we're not hanging around the coffee machine or the water cooler as much. But yeah, a few people are, I'm senior enough, you know, I don't care. I mean, I'm not worrying about what my colleagues think about what, as long as I don't stop being a scientist and how I approach it. I understand why most of them don't want to. But your point about ghosts and UFOs in the same category, you're right, they're not, because scientists have plausible and credible evidence for believing there's life in the universe, even if we haven't found it yet, and for believing that some fraction of those living worlds, those Earth-like planets, could have intelligent life and technology. But the universe is a very big place, so you absolutely don't get to connect the dots and say, because they might exist, again, might, they have traveled and have visited us. And the real reason that the ghosts and the UFOs are bracketed, especially in the United States, is that they're part of the popular culture. So, you know, Americans are a little more prone to conspiracy theories than I suspect Irish are, and maybe most countries. They're also,
I would say, a lot.
Yeah. Then they're also embedded in this wonderful, to me, history of science fiction, of movies, of TV shows, Star Trek, Star Wars, all these things. So Americans have been conditioned over the decades to anticipate that aliens are out there and they move around in starships and visit, and they maybe look like us, maybe not. So that's part of the ethos. That's part of the popular culture. So I think Americans' proclivity to believe in UFOs is very strong because of that amniotic fluid that you're subject to when you grow up watching all those TV shows and those movies.
It's a fascinating subject. It'd be interesting to see what the next report will say, if anything at all, probably just enough to get people typing furiously on the internet. But it's a fascinating subject. Chris Simby, Professor of Astronomy at the University of Arizona. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, good to be with you.
I know Chris said that some of these artifacts were easily recreated by other people, but I mean, you know, these military personnel are probably used to seeing things on their screen. I'm not closed to the idea that they may have spotted something that is beyond a blip on the screen or a speck on the lens. Love to know what you make of it. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. Right, time to look back at your texts and tweets from last week, and we were talking about going to Mars. Hugh from West Cork says, I have to say the obsession with space and Mars is complete hogwash. A focus on our own bloody planet and how we could develop new living possibilities on a rapidly changing Earth. Well, I suppose, why would you ever want to leave West Cork is the first question, Hugh. But look, the thing is that, I mean, it's a genuine thought experiment to say, what if we focused everyone, every single living person on climate change, everyone, that was your job, it was climate change for the next 5 years, you didn't do anything except focus on climate change, you know, 80% of your job, 20% is making the food that you make, whatever it is, you, and we just get everybody thinking about it, every man, woman, child, what could we do? Because if you accept that everybody can't be working on that, then you have to also then accept by that logic that people have to do other jobs. And then you have to also accept that some people work in marketing and they market, you know, I don't know, those popper things that kids have, you know, that's at someone's job. And you kind of say, well, why are we doing that? Or, you know, those nodding dog things, you kind of say, well, that's someone's job, is to design and then promote and market those. And then there's sales and then there's a website. So when you think about it, there's a lot of jobs that are, you know, I would consider to be pretty pointless, but people are doing them anyway. Like, I think it's fine that we're obsessing with space and Mars. If you want to, you know, cut out industries, I could think of a whole bunch of other jobs that I think are completely useless and do nothing but damage the Earth. At least exploring space and Mars is both giving us a new knowledge about the world. And I think new knowledge about the world and the universe has always been a good thing. It's always been helpful to us. But also, it's created jobs, it's created new sorts of industries, and it's inspirational. You know, making fake poo as a joke or whoopee cushions, like, you know, we got a question, you know, what are we doing here, what are we making those things, and who are we making them for? So I dismiss your comment, Hugh, but I understand why. Living in West Cork, you'd be wondering, why would you want to go anywhere? Another comment on the human brain, someone says, are male and female reactions different? There is, there's been a few books written about the differences between men, male and female brains. And you're going to kill me now. I can't remember. I can't remember whether or not there were major structural differences. My gut thought, if I'm trying to think back, is that structurally there isn't that much different, but culturally we have changed quite a bit. But I don't think men and women's brains are enormously different in any way. So in terms of how they react, I imagine that's probably culturally more relevant. The environment, how you react to something, is probably based on your genetics as well, far more than I would say your gender. We were talking about the moon, and Ken texted in. He says, he came from the dock. He says, hang on, the dark side of the moon is a constant. Is the moon not rotating on its axis like the Earth is? Well, Ken, yes, it is technically, but the rotation of the moon around the Earth is pretty much matched up to the rotation of the Earth over the course of a year around the sun. And because of that, we always see the same side of the moon. The moon does not rotate daily like the Earth does. So the moon sort of sticks at the same angle around the Earth. And so we never see the other side of the moon. And this is surprising to many. A guy who finished his text with Amadon, I'm thinking he's calling me an Amadon and his name is not Amadon, although he's capitalized it. He says, there is no dark side of the moon. There is a dark side of the moon. You can travel to the light side of the moon, which is the moon that faces the sun 99% of the time, except during a lunar eclipse, of course. Or you can travel to the dark side of the moon, which is the bit that the sun doesn't see and obviously does not get light because of that linkage to the Earth's rotation. So we always see the same thing. And you can prove this to yourself by, on a clear night in December, looking at and taking a photograph of the moon, and then on a clear night in June, looking at and taking a photograph of the moon, and you'll find that they are very similar images indeed. Oliver says, just listening to the program now, and I thought I'd share a photograph on Twitter. Yeah, you can see that photograph if you have a look at our Twitter page. It's amazing, actually. I don't remember having that good a view of the moon when I was a kid, but then I was short-sighted and I only really got my eyes fixed until I was later. So maybe that's what it was. Maybe when you're a child, I wasn't up late enough to see a good view of the moon, and then I had really bad eyesight. So that would probably explain that mystery. One person says, this is probably too late now because it is lashing rain today, but someone says, please ask your listeners to leave water out for the birds, ideally in a shaded spot. I'm sorry, we get to your text a week later, and last week we were in the middle of a huge heat wave in the country. And I imagine it's about now that everyone's Amazon orders are arriving of, you know, cooling fans and awnings and parasols and all those things that we will not need again for a long time. Finally, we had text from Teresa saying, great radio, keeping me sane on the cross-country drive today. Well, that's lovely, Teresa. I hope you got there safe. And that's it for this week's Future Proof. Thanks to production team Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, Garrett Mahal, and Steve McClune, who was on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.